Sad time for us here at South Beach Sessions, as this is our final episode under the ESPN umbrella. Many thanks have to go out to PG Anacini and Anthony Calatayud, who were essential during our time here at ESPN, and not just building out this brand, the South Beach Sessions brand, but also the Le Batard and Friends Network. There's so many people to thank on the technical end, which is why I pushed Dan out of the way, because he doesn't really have the technical background in this. But just suffice to say that this podcast doesn't get off the ground, and all the creative things that we've done with Le Batard and Friends over at ESPN does not happen without the help of those two people primarily. So I wanted to make sure we shouted them out before we got going here with our interview with Big Boy. Dan and Big Boy become random friends, so this one should be really good. I also want to thank ZipRecruiter, the presenting sponsor of South Beach Sessions, because they've been with us basically since day one. They've been a great partner. Week in and week out, ZipRecruiter is always there for us with their support. So thank you so much to them. Let's get on with this Big Boy interview. Famously, one half of Outkast alongside Andre 3000. Dan and Big Boy get into, obviously, his time with Outkast, which is still active even though they're not making music. Outkast never broke up. We talk about Big Boy's unique knack to stay away from all the drama in hip-hop. A lot of drama in hip-hop, but you never see Big Boy's name attached to it. We find out what's happened to the Boom Boom Room. Those people that are sort of similar in age to me probably remember Big Boy's amazing classic episode of MTV Cribs, where we all discovered the Boom Boom Room. So real fun things there. You're going to enjoy this South Beach Sessions, the final one under our ESPN umbrella, but do not fret. South Beach Sessions is going nowhere. If you subscribe to South Beach Sessions, you'll be happy to know that new episodes that will continue once our time with ESPN ends will still show up on your phone. If you haven't subscribed to South Beach Sessions, do so now. Just click subscribe right here in your platform of choice. Stay with us as we will continue to push out great content. We have really good South Beach Sessions lined up that'll continue to come out during a free agency period here as we figure out what the next move is. But we know one thing is for certain. We're going to keep delivering on some digital content for you, the Le Batard listener. So please, subscribe, rate, review to this podcast right now and all of the Le Batard and Friends properties like Mystery Crate and Supodity as well, because those are coming with us. They will continue. There will be fresh episodes, and you want to make sure you still get that Le Batard content. And we're leaning on you here because, look, this is a digital play right now, and it was important to us to keep those properties under our umbrella. So please show your support and subscribe to Supodity, Mystery Crate, and this podcast, South Beach Sessions. We get going with Big Boy now.
Big Boy, how did you find music? What are the places in your childhood where you realized the light went off and you're like, no, this is what I need to be?
It started from my grandmother. She would play records, Bob Marley, Buffalo Soldier, and she would send us to the record store every week to buy records. And, you know, we were little kids and I fell in love with music from there. Yeah, man.
And did you have all the resources you needed to make sure that was an enterprise that was worth chasing? Like, how young were you?
My grandmother, we were like 5 or 6 years old. And that's where the love for music began. And then, you know, from there, I started, you know, listening to different things like Kate Bush. My uncle would turn me on to Led Zeppelin and Alice in Chains and different music like that. So my musical palette just expanded and I just knew I loved music. And just so happens, you know, when I got to Atlanta, it was a gift from God. Me and my partner connected, and this is what we were put on this earth to do, is to school the people through music.
So help me understand before that, though, before Atlanta, where did you end up getting inspired? Like, who were the people that you were looking at? And you're like, oh, man, you can do this for a living. You can make a career out of this. Because Led Zeppelin is a bit surprising, even understanding that you've got a broad palate.
I don't think I was looking at, you can make a living from it. I was just like, this is what I want to do. Just the creation of new sounds and just how the music moved me, you know what I mean? I used to ride my bike to school and listening to Kate Bush, and that was just motivation, you know? And then I got into the Guns N' Roses and the Isley Brothers and Patti LaBelle, the Temptations, and just you know, it's like just seeing all the different music and how it moves people, it was intriguing to me. And I was like, oh, I want to do this.
Did you find a lot of people had the tastes as broad as you did there? A lot of people had the interests as broad as you did there.
Some did, you know, but it came from family members, like the crazy uncle, like my mom's brother, Russell. He was a real eclectic guy. He was a chef, but he was into all alternative everything. So he was bringing home reissues of old Prince vinyl, you know what I'm saying? And I was just like, oh my God, he was just turning me on and stuff. And he had a record player and we would just play records. And so he introduced me to a lot of music outside of just reggae and soul music.
Did you find hip hop to be somewhat limiting in that respect, just because your palate was so broad and because you're liking so many different, like these are artists that you're talking about. This is not where the game generally comes from. It's usually copycat from within the industry. It's not this broad.
To me, we always wanted to be our own thing, you know what I mean? And to kind of box yourself into just being one thing, we didn't want to do that. So we ventured off, you know, into everything else. That's why we called the group Outkast, because we didn't want to be like nobody else. And we didn't want nobody to be like us. And we never wanted to sound the same on no album. We wanted to sound different every time we came out. And it was all about, Outkast is all about evolution and evolving and recreating yourself, you know?
Was there second place in terms of the name you chose? Is there anything that you remember creatively about the discussion that would be remembered, that it was almost not Outkast, it was almost blank?
Yeah, well, the first name of the group was Two Shades Deep. And I was Black Dog and Dre was Black Wolf. So then it was a singing group at our high school called itself Four Shades Deep. They went on to becoming members of Jagged Edge, the singing group. So we like, okay, well, we got to find us another name. So we went in the dictionary,
right?
And we looked up Misfits. And we was like, oh, that might be good. We was going through A, B, C, D, E. We got the M, Misfits. Like, no, that ain't going to do it. And when we got to Outkast, we was like, that's it. And we used the pronunciation spelling of the word. And, I mean, that's how the stars lined up.
And why were you Misfits? Like, it's because Outkast, you're talking about doing it differently. Misfits, what specifically were Misfits about you?
So, I mean, we just didn't fit in with whatever was going on on the scene at all. Like, you know, we were both Jedi lyricists. Like, we took lyricism seriously, like so seriously. We wanted to be respected as MCs first. And we worked on our craft. And so, like, it was going to be Misfits on because we didn't fit in, Outkast, because we didn't fit in, you know, we are a part of society, but not, you know, kind of like overviewing what's going on in the world.
I talked to Method Man about the craft here recently, a couple of weeks ago, and the obsession, the OCD of how it is that you have to sculpt the craft from an early age when you've got all the time in the world, all the ambition in the world. Do you remember some of your earliest stuff, like the number of repetitions that you would put into sculpting that, like your very earliest stuff as a lyricist?
For one, I still write, like, you know what I mean? Like, I see, like, now, like, a lot of rappers kind of rap off of the phone. I still write. I use a legal pad just to kind of recite lyrics before you lay them down. They get embedded in your head. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm a writer, so I'm writing all the time, whether it's like certain lines or notes or bridges or things like that. So when you go in the studio, you got a little bit of ammo to pull from. You know what I'm saying?
And how about your earliest stuff, though? When you look back at just the sculpting of the craft, like when you were in the very early stages at the height of hunger and ambition, how much OCD was there involved with, I got to get this just exactly right. If I'm a note off, none of this works.
That's to this day. That's till this day, you know. I'm a perfectionist too. So when I write or when I make songs, I don't want to repeat the same cadence. I don't want to use the same words. I don't take from my older stuff and put it in my new stuff. You know what I'm saying? What I like to do is be fresh and thought-provoking with every song. And that's the challenge. And it's also the beauty of making music, because when you finally get that line or you get that different sound, the way that you spit that rhyme, like, it's like, oh, you struck gold.
Where is the majority of your support coming from as you're chasing the dream early on?
Support comes from with a man up above, first and foremost, but then it's the Dungeon family. You know what I mean? Like Goody Mob, like Organized Noise, Big Rube, like all of us were living in this house called the Dungeon. And, you know, we all fed off each other. Like, we were all you know, coming up together. And it was like the Professor Xavier School, like the X-Men, you know what I mean? We were all trying to learn our crafts, and that's exactly what it was. And we inspired each other.
Did you have anyone from hip hop who reigned as the influence?
We listened to everything. My favorite group, like the rap group, was N.W.A. You know, Love Tribe Called Quest, just about everybody. You know, we listened to the whole Native Tongue movement. Out the West Coast, you had E-40 and you had the whole Hieroglyphics crew. Like, I mean, that was some real MCs. So, you know, definitely like was a fan of lyricists.
When you're talking about the support of Goody Mob, what does it end up looking like?
It ends up looking like the song Dirty South, which is, you know, now they call, you know, Atlanta, the Georgia, whatever, the Dirty South. It looks like Black Ice, one of the hardest Goody songs ever. It looks like Pray for the Sheep, which is the newest record I did with the Goody Mob. And Dre did one called No Cigar. Goody Mob out right now. It's called Survival Kit Crazy. Jamming, man. It's the Dungeon Family Resurgence, man, and we having a good time.
Well, tell me about that, though, because you it doesn't seem... I'd like you and Andre to be working more often together.
Yeah.
So how infrequent is this, and why is it not happening more frequently? Because everybody wants that.
Yeah, I mean, it's all in time, you know? Like, you know what I'm saying? My partner... He comes out when he comes out. We've done so much music to, like, you know, it's brotherhood right now. You know what I mean? Like, we talk or text, you know, at least once or twice a week, and we're brothers. So, I mean, we don't necessarily have to be doing music. Like, will it happen? Got to talk to the Lord.
But you're brothers, but you're not very similar, are you? Or do I have it wrong? Because he seems more like a butterfly and you seem more like a bulldog.
That's perception, you know? I guess it's very reclusive to where me, I'm always active. I'm always out with the squad, me and the yo always recording, you know. I still do music all the time because my kid's going to college. What else am I going to do?
That's it? That's all that's left. Now that you don't have to be a hands-on active dad, this is where your time is being spent.
Yep, back in the studio.
I don't know how uncomfortable or comfortable you are talking about this, so please help me down the path and knock me down if I'm in the wrong place. But when it came to specifically the Badu relationship with Andre 3000, how did you see him influenced in ways that were creative that you sort of enjoyed? Because she has a way of being a muse for people.
He was already like that. I think it's a big misconception. He was already like that. They complimented each other, so that's really what it is.
but you accept him the way that he is when you talk about brotherhood, right? You weren't trying to change anything. Like, this is a guy who you just fit with, even though from the outside it might look to some people that it doesn't quite fit, that these are two different human beings connected by music, connected by art.
Yeah, I mean, that's something the label created, that whole moniker, the player and the poet. But me and Dre really are the same person. Really?
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so it's a bit of a marketing. You're saying that is the label created because we've got these two guys and that's what it's meant to look like because that helps sell, but it's not real.
No, not that. I mean, it's just like, I mean, we had different images, but as people, like we have the same sort of beliefs and we do enjoy the same things. Like, you know, we're brothers, like for sure.
So you start working together and you know immediately that you have something special?
Yes. Yes. It was a group of like five of us, like, you know, all in a new school, and me and Dre kind of clicked up out of the five, and it just, you know, it just came, you know, we started, you know, just saying, let's take it serious. And we would practice every day. And then once we hooked up with Organized Noise, that was it.
So how soon did the reward start? How long did that take?
We started with 16 and 17 together, and then about time we were like, before we were 18, we was at the Dungeon, and before we were 19, we had a gold single, which was called Players Ball. It was the first song we released on the Christmas album on LaFace Records, and that gave us the opportunity to make our first album, Southern Player Listed, before we were even legal, you know?
How much did life change right there?
it's fast. It's just, you start going fast because then it's on the road touring and being away from your family, but also on the two of us creating, you know, AT Aliens, creating Aquemini, you know what I mean? Like being in close quarters like that, we just, you know, the ideas get to flowing and you just, you know, keep it pushing.
Is that the happiest time? Because I can't imagine success and dreams coming true and being able to be in that playground and you've got the hunger of youth and you got the stamina of youth and you're chasing your dreams. Like, I can't imagine a better time for you guys than that. Even understanding that in adulthood and through parenthood, you tap into all sorts of different feelings of happiness.
Yeah, it's still fun. You know what I mean? Like, to this day, performing is like my favorite part of making music. When you create something and you get a chance to see people's faces when you perform for the first time, it's like, you can't beat that.
And so when in, and I know we've talked to you about some of this, but when in the heyday of MTV Cribs, when you are showing people the strip pole in your house, going back to that time, that is now your mother's house, correct? Or
No, actually she has another house now. I moved her out of that and I own that property. And actually I'm about to Airbnb that. That's breaking news on the Airbnb.
Wait a minute. The boom boom room is going to be on Airbnb. You've got to be charging maximum amounts for that.
It's going to be crazy. It's crazy. I've been remodeling the whole thing, you know, and Airbnb reached out to me because they're doing some things like with the house from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And they was like, we want to, do you have access to the house from Cribs? I'm like, I own it. You know what I'm saying? That's one thing I did learn is as a youngster is, you know, buy property because they ain't going to make no more land. You know what I'm saying? So I've been heavy in the real estate game since I was a young man. And yes, the game has been good to me.
All right. Well, hold on a second. Tell me about that, because one of the things that is always lamented in the Black community, and especially when riots start and you see things are burning and then people say, well, why would you burn your own stuff? And the retort is, well, no, we don't own any of this. That part of the thing that holds Black people back is an absence of ownership over stuff so that you can create generational wealth. Where did you learn there that, hey, I need to get in the land game. I need to own stuff.
To me, it's all about schooling and teaching people on how to do things, you know. And I come from a family of military men. Like, my granddaddy was a staff sergeant in the Air Force. My father was in the Marine Corps. He was a sergeant. My uncles were Marines. So there was a sense of discipline. And my great-grandfather owned land. And I learned from them. And it's all about ownership. You have to own something in this world, you know, even down to your publishing, if you're an artist, you know what I mean? Or if you're a writer, right now in times when that you can't do concerts, them royalty checks, that's like one of the best 401ks in the world. Like, if you own it, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, my partner ain't really been on stage. He ain't been on stage in, you know, ages. We did the Outkast 20 tour, but this is for recreation, you know? And this is right now is for my kids. And I'm teaching them how to do it, for sure.
Did you get burned much by the record industry early?
No.
Oh, wow. You outsmarted the game? Wait a minute. You had the discipline of learning in your family to not get burned by the game when you were young.
Yeah, that and having people that love you, like L.A. Reid. And I got to give credit to Organized Noise, who signed us, our producers. They allowed us to have our own publishing because we were writers, you know, so we always owned our publishing. And then we started producing records on our second album, songs like Elevators and AT Aliens. And we produced like half that record, you know, so we were producing and writing. A lot of people don't know that me and Dre produce as well. So we were on both sides of the table and they never took our publishing. So that's what I learned, that you don't burn other people either. Because when I signed Killer Mike and Janelle Monae, they had the freedom to do whatever they wanted to do after they came from under me. And now they're both successful. And that's how you pass the spirit down.
You handed that down. Wow, yeah. You didn't. That can't be very normal. And that's a dirty game, right? Like, you've heard the horror
story. It's a dirty game, man. But, you know, I'm a man. I believe in the Lord. You feel me? And then I believe in karma. And it do come back. Yes, sir.
Killer Mike, he what a representative on behalf of that city, dude. Like unbelievable how strong that guy is just at everything. You must take great pride in having been able to have him achieve that platform, because you passed down some of the stuff you passed down.
I love it, man. And he's like I said, he's like a brother as well. Like, he stopped by the studio whenever I'm in town. If I'm in the studio, he come by, you know. And he's also a successful businessman in Atlanta as well. Like, him and T.I. got into the real estate game as well. They got Bankhead Seafood. Killer Mike has barbershops all around Atlanta, the Swag Shop. Shout out to them. He also got a barbershop inside Phillips Arena, the basketball arena. So, yeah, I'm proud. You know what I mean? I'm proud, yeah.
And so how did you feel? And I know you don't do politics or beef or any of that stuff, so I'm not interested in dragging you into any of those places. But how did you feel as a proud Atlanta man when at the beginning of this pandemic, at the beginning of the George Floyd stuff, that guy specifically under your tutelage with his strength gets in front of people emotionally, angrily, and in a really sophisticated fashion, makes the argument for black rights in a way that's inarguable? Like, I know that person and you've seen that much from him, but to see it on behalf of your city, what did that do to you?
I mean, he's always been like that. Always been like that. It's just like now he has a bigger platform and people are recognizing the greatness, not only of him being an artist, but for him being a critical thinker and a brilliant mind when it comes to life and lifestyle and the upliftment of people, period.
Have you had a greater joy professionally than representing your city at the Super Bowl, the way that you represented your city during the halftime show of the Super Bowl?
I think the only thing bigger than that was when we won Album of the Year at the Grammys, and no hip hop artist has won it since then. And that says a lot. But yeah, that was the most similar moment that I can imagine. But that was crazy. The Super Bowl in Atlanta, the only thing that could have been better, if the Falcons would have been there and they would have won. But we still won because we did Kryptonite. You feel me? And we said ATL to the whole world, and the whole world said it back. You feel me?
Where were the emotions that day? Like, what? Take me through sort of everything that day, because I don't know whether you can be moved to tears or not. You you tell the story of your dog being taken off by some bird of prey with a dark grin on your face. So you are not, I don't know if this is something. Okay, hold on a second. We got to play the sound for the audience that doesn't know what it is that we're talking about, because I want to get into your emotions of like what that meant to you and articulating to people representing Atlanta, doing it your way with your music in the center as a football fan in the center of Americana. I want to get to that. But first, the dark humor of Big Boy here on with Kerry Champion and his beloved deceased dog, Halle Berry.
So let's talk about Bad or Bougie. Some of my producers told me to explain this to the audience. So how would you, shout out to Mikos, how would you explain Bad and Bougie?
I guess, you know, having an attitude and a certain confidence about yourself where you just don't just deal with anybody. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, you got to be a super raw dog and so fresh, so clean at all times.
You got a dog named Halle Berry. Is she bad or is she bougie?
She's dead.
No!
Yeah.
I did not know that. That is awful.
I know,
My producer didn't know that. I feel awful.
Sorry.
You enjoyed saying she's dead that way. I see it on your face now, and I saw it on your face then. You were trying to hide it. You enjoyed saying my dog is dead.
No, I just really just, sometimes I just say whatever's on my mind, and it just comes out, and that was just the facts. And for her to ask me that and not know, I mean, yeah, I'm kind of psyched out.
All right. So emotionally, the Super Bowl, like what are the snapshot moments that you remember? And did Big Boy at any point get moved to tears somewhere within that?
No, I didn't get moved to tears. It was just electric, you know, just knowing that it was that many eyes on you at that time. It's like the whole world is watching. My mother was there. My kids and my wife were all sitting up in the suite. And it was just, it went by so quick. Like, you know, we rehearsed it like for like a couple of weeks beforehand, but then when you get to the actual performance, it goes so fast, it's like, damn, it's over. But it was just floating, man. It was great, man.
Did anything go wrong, or you got everything right? Everything that you had in rehearsals, everything went right.
It was perfect, man. It was perfect, seamless.
Do you have a story involving any one of your hits that people might be surprised to learn? We weren't sure that that was going to be successful. Or do you often think that whatever it is you're doing is going to be something that should be a hit?
It's up for the people to decide. Like, I mean, when you make an album, like instead of making like, you know, we like to do all killer, no filler. So we like to think every song is a single, you know, as an artist and the time that you put into the song. But people are going to gravitate towards certain things faster. But then, as you can see now, you know, being in the game 20 plus years, people are going back discovering older material, you know, like we just had the 20th anniversary of Stankonia, and it jumped back up to number 13 on the charts 20 years later. Like, you know what I mean? So our music is timeless. And whether you discover it now or discover it later, it's going to be here and it's going to move you forever.
So, but you don't have a specific story on a song that you just underestimated in terms of what it would be popularly, or do you just put it out into the universe and let the universe have its way with it?
Yeah, just put it out, man. Just put it out. You never know, you know?
Well, that's very spiritually let go. Usually people with ambition go and chase things. That might be something that comes from your faith, too. Like, it's not that easy to let that stuff go. Usually you take pride in it, and it's not just the joy of creation. You have an expectation for that creation.
Nah, I mean, once I put it together and put it out, let the people have it. I got to dig it first, you know, and if I put it out, my name on it, my face on it, I approve all the time.
In what ways other than discipline have you been shaped by your military background?
They taught structure, and I used a combination of parenting styles from my great-grandparents and my grandparents to my dad to raise my own kid. And now I have three successful kids. One just, she graduated from Auburn. She's a child psychologist, my daughter, my oldest, and she worked with autistic kids. And that brings her so much joy to work with kids on the spectrum and have an understanding of that. That was her passion, and she did that, and I raised her. My son is, Bamboo, is an architect, going to be an architect, graduating from the new school in New York City, the prestigious art school. Matter of fact, he doing online classes right now, the same time I'm on the Zoom with you. This is his junior year. My youngest boy plays for the Oregon Ducks, cross pad number 28. You see what I got around my ring? He let me hold his Rose Bowl championship ring. They won the Pac-12 championship and the Rose Bowl. And this is his sophomore year. So I'm an empty nester. I did something right. I learned that from my elders.
I just can't believe that you had a son on the way, name of Bamboo, is now an architect. Like, that, what is that? Like, that's a very meticulous craft he chose. Is that more of the family discipline being passed down? Because architecture is very precise, very difficult. You have to have a certain brain type to chase that.
Yes, I mean, his architecture is his first major, and art is his second. So he wants to be a builder, you know, and we're in a real estate game. So when somebody draw up some plans, we'll keep it all in the family.
Like
the Godfather.
Oh, nice.
Like the Godfather.
Like the Godfather.
You feel what I'm saying? Join the family business.
Okay.
Hey, yeah.
You realize that. And so you take a degree of pride, though, on the specifics of not just that you raised college kids, but you raised college kids with specific careers that are the careers of professionals. Like, they did not choose the dreamy creative path the way you did, because even football demands a meticulousness that people don't understand.
Yeah. I mean, both my boys played football, and one of them just chose to do something else. But that was like a certain form of discipline and just kind of just showing them teamwork, team building, because they played baseball and soccer and everything, you know what I mean? But they gravitated towards football, and I just taught them to be tough, and they just enjoy it. They enjoy it. And I'm just proud, man. I couldn't did it all without the help of my entire family. Me being on the road, going on tour, like I used to take my kids on tour and put them in the videos. And, you know, I was there. And they was there through the whole ride with me. And to see them now thriving and be successful, like, I just feel, you know, thank the Lord, Jesus, for blessing me and protecting my family in all this time, for sure.
What advice would you give to parents listening to this on what to do in order to get your kids, nudge them toward happy along that path?
What you got to do, and this is like the real deal, you got to talk to them when they're babies. You got to talk to them like a person. You have to talk to them. You have to teach them, you know, when they're young. Like, I have a friend now that has like a, since his little son was like 6 months old, he like got big pieces of paper and like put, like wrote chair on chair, pool table on pool table, lamp on lamp, on a, for a little baby to learn. And then now this boy is speaking like crazy. So stuff like that, you have to talk to your children. You got to spend time with them. Don't let that TV raise your kids.
Well, you've seen some things change. I know that the guys that I admire in hip hop are getting to be our age. So you have seen changes and you have evolved with the music. You're still doing it out there in a way creatively that, you know, young guys can't say anything bad about what you did. No matter how much fighting there is in hip hop, what you create, like, you don't find a whole lot of people saying, they don't have anything bad to say about what your credentials are.
No, not never, man. Not never. That's when you get to, when you get the god status, when you get to be a god, a rap god. I said a rap god. Hey, man, we're just having fun, man. But it's all about positive vibrations. And, you know, the music is our gift and we share it with the world. And we just, you know, want everybody to thrive, seek the truth and be happy.
How much religion was there in your youth?
It was a lot. Like, grew up in the church, the Baptist church, great grandmama and them, like big mom, like great grandmama, Bible study, went on Wednesday, church, Sunday school, church, Sunday. You know, my mom took us to go be with our great grandmother. So we stayed out of the streets. We're in church on the weekends, you know? So my faith has been strong since the beginning. I just know that this is why I've been put here, is to make music and to minister to the people. You know, it's bigger than just rap songs. We like to deliver messages in our music. Kara West once said it best, is edutainment. You have to educate as well as entertain.
What can you tell me about Big Mama?
She was the best, man. The best. Flossie Mae Hamilton. Yep. Had her own garden. They used to make us watch Star Trek and wet country westerns because there was only one TV in the house. And my great granddaddy was always having on Bonzai, Bonanza, something. So we wasn't really watching cartoons because he was watching Star Trek, which was kind of selfish, but it was his house anyway. But we'd be in the yard, you know, be in the yard playing stickball, or they'd make us go in the garden and, you know, kind of pick corn and help Big Mama pick peas and, you know, get our hands dirty. So I had a well-rounded childhood.
What is her story? What is her backstory? Like, what can you tell us about the ways that, I don't know how and why the specifics of where it is you were raised or who it is in the earliest years that was shaping you, but tell me about that person and what that person had to do with, you know, specifically how you're imprinted.
Well, it was my great-grandmother, then it was my grandmother, my dad's mom. That's who I spent most of my time with. And she was just she was a soul singer. I didn't find that out till like later on, way after I was in music. I didn't even know she did music. But that was, I guess that's why she was sending us to the store to get the Bob Marleys and the Patti LaBelles and all the soul records every week. And she nurtured us like it was me. I was raised with my cousins and my brother. We were all like back-to-back kids. Like my cousins, me and my cousins have our mamas, our sisters, and our daddies, our brothers. So I got first cousins, for real. And we were all like brothers and sisters and still are. So it was close-knit like that.
How do you and Dre, after all of these years, these partnerships can be hit on so many sides by temptations and egos, and they don't last this long. Like, how are you guys able to maintain a partnership that is allowed to age in a way that never seems to have many of the poisons that I associate with, you know, fame and money and success?
It was all about brotherhood first, then music. And it's never about greed. We don't fall out about no money. We might have a difference of opinion sometimes, but we talk through it if we got anything, you know what I'm saying? And so it's not, it's never nothing. And even if, like, if I don't see him for a month or 2 months or 3 months, the day that we see each other, it's like we hadn't missed a day. And we just immediately go right back to high school kicking like that, you know?
And how does the collaboration work? Are there many creative arguments? Like, are you allowed to get heated up about, or is it all chill?
It's pretty much all chill. Like, Dre's, he's pretty passive. Like, but if he want something on the record, like, we'll try it. Like, that's one thing about both of us. It's like, okay, we experiment with the sound. I know, remember we was doing AT Aliens, right? And the bass line is doom, 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 doom. We actually tried to put a tuba on there playing it at first. And it would have made the songs sound a hell of a lot different. But we tried. And when he was like, man, let's try the tuba, I was like, boy, stop. He like, let's just try it. So we tried it. It didn't work. But everything else we tried is trial and error. Like, listen to them albums.
Do you have an instance where maybe you don't speak for a month or two because someone has gotten angry about something and there needs to be a cooling off? Or is that simply not something that would ever be present in your relationship?
No, we don't do that. Life is too short and precious. We don't do that.
You realize how special and rare that is, right? Like, you've been around the music industry enough to know that no matter how spiritual you are, no matter how loving and good vibes you are, like, that's not that normal.
Yeah, no, I know, man. So that's a tragedy. People got to, you know, really got to think before you say negative things. And you have to look at stuff from the other person's side. Sometimes the first thing ain't the right thing to say. So you think about stuff before you say it. You know what I'm saying? That way you don't manifest that negative energy, or you don't hurt anybody's feelings. You tell your truth. You know what I mean? You say how you feel. I think that's the beauty of me and my partner, is like, we both don't bite our tongues when it comes to our opinion about anything, you know? And we can agree to disagree and just be like, hey, well, that's what it is. And it be real, always real.
Have you managed to sort of slalom course through public fame without like a whole lot of public shame, or, you know, things that happen where you get into uncomfortable situations? Like, have you managed all of that without, like, I can't remember with you a bad public moment, and you've been in the limelight for a long time.
I've been busy being a daddy and a rocker band, a rock star, real life rock star. And a daddy, that's a mean habit right there, you know. But I'm all about positive energy, man, and good vibes. And when you give that out into the universe, it comes back to you tenfold.
How did parenthood change you?
Balance. You know, having three children, that's, you have to split the time between music and television, producing and everything, and you got to go to the football games, piano recitals, the go meet the teachers at school and do all the parenting stuff too. So my calendar was always full. Like, I would have a show, say, on a Saturday, and my boy had a game Saturday morning. I'd catch his game, fly out, do the show, and then come back to have breakfast with my family on Sunday. So it gave me a foundation and balance. Yeah.
Why was it important for you to be that kind of present? Where did you learn that?
I learned it from my family. I'm very family oriented, you know. Like, I have a big family, and we all hold each other up.
And you didn't have some of the problems that come sometimes with success and family members and expectations on, you need to take care of this, money, all the stuff that happens. Like, how that seems like a difficult thing to manage, period, for anybody.
Not when you done broke everybody off already. When you done took care of everybody three or four times, everybody's straight.
because you own all your own shit, and so you're good at real estate and good at everything else. So money doesn't become a problem because you have enough of it that you to go around so that everybody can be happy. Are you good at no? Like, do you not have any issue with that because you don't have to say no because you've got real freedom?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to say no because, like, they don't ask anymore like that because everybody's pretty much independent. But at first, you know, to help everybody get, you know, to where they're trying to be, like, it's like a team. Like, hey, you want to try to start this business? Okay, cool. Let's do that. You want to do this? Cool. Let's do that. Now it's just a certain level of just honor that we all have. Like, we all have each other. And if anybody ever needs anything, everybody's going to be there for that person.
Is there anything about the business that you had to learn the hard way?
The hard way. The whole thing is a lesson, you know. Like I said, we were blessed to retain ownership of our works. So
it changes everything, though, right?
That's the battle. That's the battle.
But I don't know how you knew to do that. It was just fairness. You were surrounded by godliness and people who wanted to take care of you like that. And it was simple fairness at the front end of the game. That's as ridiculous as hearing that make an appearance in boxing. It's just not the way the business works.
That's why I'm still in business with the same people. L.A. Reid, who I started with. I'm on Hicko Records now. Right now, I have my own label, Purple Ribbon Records. I own my masters on his label, and he distributes my music almost 30 years later. Organized Noise, still producing albums for me. We got the Big Boy Sleepy Brown album coming called The Big Sleepover. It's out of here. If you ain't heard the singles Can't Sleep and Intentions, go get those. We're still in business together because they never f***ed us. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're still growing, learning together, be doing business together, and still here after all this time because there was no bad business.
I mean, it's just so beautiful, though. The idea that you would have it's just crazy to me that you can have a growth of industry, a growth of success. Everyone profits. It's peaceful. It's easy. Everyone trusts each other. Money's not going to come between us. We're family. Like, nobody gets that kind of run of dominoes falling together.
It's called being blessed and highly favored.
And did you realize early on that you were that? Or when did you feel like that is what you were, blessed and highly favored?
I knew that as a kid. My grandma taught me that. You know, you're God's child. God's child, and I know it.
And so did you ever struggle with confidence, or were you getting so much love at home and from all the support systems that you didn't go through an insecure stage?
No, I think the thing with me is I battle myself because I want to be better than the old me, better than the last me, better than the last verse, better than the last beat, you know? So it's always... of course, I'm a Jedi master, but I'm also a master is always a student because you're always learning and learning new techniques of the game, you know? So, I mean, I'm encouraged and also enlightened when we make new music.
You mentioned The Big Sleepover. What is it that you want people to know about the collaboration with Dre and Goody Mob?
Well, the collaboration with... Goody Mob and Andre, we are on the new Goody Mob album. Dre is on a song called No Cigar. I'm on a song called Pray for the Sheep. Jamming. They back-to-back on the Goody Mob album. The Big Sleepover is the Big Boy and Sleepy Brown collaborative project. All killer, no filler. We finished this album before this the whole pandemic thing happened. We finished the record already. We got a new song out called We the Ones Who Fight that we just did on Jimmy Fallon. We about to drop the video for that one. And then the whole full album is going to come at the top of the year because we're going to let the Goody Mob out and breathe for a little bit.
Have you done a collaboration? Is there anywhere along the path where you've done something that you were just legitimately awed by the person? I know that you feel like there aren't a whole lot of peers or that there ain't a whole lot of people who are better at this than you are in general. I would imagine you feel that, or you should feel that if you don't. But have you ever been in the presence of someone where you're like, man, this is just a real honor to perform with this person because this person is my equal as a craftsman, as a musician?
I love performing with the group Little Dragon. I respect them. And we did a song called Mama Told Me. And I just, like, somehow it came, my son brought it up to me, and I totally forgot that we performed it live, and they came all the way from Sweden, where they're from, and we did it for the first time live in Texas, and I was kind of in awe of them because I had loved them as a band, and for us to create a jam together was dope.
Did you ever do a whole lot of shitty venues? Did you ever have to do, do you remember anything where you looked around the room and you were like, this is kind of sad, I should be performing somewhere larger than this?
When we first started, I mean, you got to start from the A. We performed at Tunnel in New York. That was like one of the hardest crowds ever, you know? you got to hit those seedy spots too. You got to hit them because that's where your roots are going to grow and where you're going to start to develop the foundation. Because when you see like those dive bars and things like that, where, you know, you might just be an unknown band in there, they're creating a fan base, you know, by playing those spots. So you want to hit everything until you get to the stadiums and the arenas and the festivals. So it don't matter if it's 500 or 100,000 people, you know what I'm saying? Like, we're going to rock them.
What do you remember about Tough Crowd at the Tunnel, though? Like, what are there some specifics there? Because unfortunately, for the storytelling part of your path, it seems like you grabbed success by the horns and then wrote it for 30 years across the rainbows and the sky. But there was a time when you had to fight for that stuff, even though it came to you early in the way of success. So in terms of the toughest crowd, what were you enduring there?
I mean, even the Tunnel was good. I'm just saying, like, as far as like just a rough club was one thing. But I guess the toughest crowd was when the crowd at the Source Awards, when they booed us when we won Best New Artist. We'd never been booed, you know, and we won an award and got booed. And that put the jumper cables in our back and made us better. So, yeah.
What do you remember about that?
That's the night that we said the South got something to say. We was putting the world on notice that here we come. Hence, a lot of energy going back. Boys, woo. It's wild.
Was that a regional booing? Like, what was happening there? Because what's the backstory?
Nah, that's when it was the whole, the East Coast, West Coast thing was going on. And, you know, we weren't a part of that because we were from the South, but we were like just the young teenagers in the crowd, like, you know, to be the best new group to come out. And I think everybody was astounded, but it's all love for everybody.
How about a time that you found yourself early on or wherever it is that you were arriving at your dreams and you come out and what greets you hits you in the chest and you're sort of like, whoa, we have made it. This is the place where I can feel we're arriving.
When Players Ball went go, we were having a rehearsal at this club in Atlanta, and L.A. Reid pulled up and stretched Lincoln limousine, and he was hanging out the window, holding up the plaque like, we did it, baby. We went go. Y'all did it. We did it. Let's do an album. And it was like, okay, it's on now.
I mean, from there, you get real freedom, right? Like, from there, every creative opportunity comes your way right there. It's hanging out the limo.
That's all the hustle and bustle of trying to get on as an artist. And when you finally get a hit record, and your first record is a hit record, and it's a Christmas song on a Christmas album that lasts past Christmas until the spring, you know, like, ain't nothing but God. Yeah.
Big boy, thank you for sharing the time with us. Always appreciate talking to you,
man. Peace.
Okay, so South Beach Sessions, as I told you in the intro, will live on. It's sad to say goodbye to ESPN, but if you're a fan of this podcast and are curious to see where we go now with it, now that we're not bound to ESPN with it, you will be plenty satisfied and intrigued. I promise you, really good interviews in the future for this podcast. It will live on. Thank you so much to everybody that helped make it happen at ESPN. And thank you, the listener, for supporting this podcast. We had a really good debut here, and we continued to build this podcast. It's the tentpole of what we did here on Levitard and Friends. So we're sad to move on from ESPN, but this is a new chapter for this podcast and our digital content, and we hope you come along for the ride. Remember to subscribe to this feed, Mystery Crate, Supodity, and, of course, the big behemoth, the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz. We promise you the radio show will continue in some form as we figure all this out collectively. So you're going to want to stand by your phone and wait for the latest episodes that drop along the way. And the only way to do that, the only way to get those notifications, is by subscribing. So please do that, as it's our digital audio currency. Thank you again. Thank you, PG. Thank you, Tony.